This week's episode covers the important topic of how to support caregivers, specifically caregivers of people with dementia. Now, dementia care tends to inform many conversations around caregiving, largely because it is such a pressing public health concern. Yet this is a conversation that goes far beyond a single diagnosis. After all, many of our occupational therapy clients receive some type of caregiving, whether it is formal or informal. And the reality is that caregivers' health, or lack thereof, is likely to impact our clients' health. I believe all occupational therapy practitioners, regardless of practice setting or patient population, will benefit from understanding the takeaways from the research we'll be looking at today and the discussion we'll be having. So let's dive in. Welcome to the OT Potential Podcast, where we dive deep into research and pull out actionable takeaways that you can implement in your practice starting today. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Lyon, OTRL. And before we dive into the topic of caregiving, I wanted to let you know that this podcast episode may qualify as continuing education for you. You are probably listening to this podcast on a free podcast platform, but to gain continuing education credit, you will need to be a member of the OT Potential Club, our OT evidence-based practice platform. At the end of this episode, I'll give you more details on how you can sign up for the OT Potential Club to take a test and generate a certificate. But bearing in mind that this is a continuing education course, I wanted to explicitly state our two learning objectives so that you can be thinking about them throughout the podcast today. Our first learning objective is that based on the research, you will be able to identify commonalities of OT interventions that had the best outcomes for supporting caregivers. And the second learning objective is that based on the research, you will be able to identify which areas of caregiver health may be most beneficial to assess for measuring outcomes. So let's begin by looking at our research analysis, and then we will bring on our expert guest, Brandy Archie, to discuss how this research can play out in your own practice. So the article that we are looking at today is called Effectiveness of Supporting Informal Caregivers of People with Dementia. It is from the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, and it was published in 2016. So let's start where the article starts, with just kind of stating explicitly why there is such a pressing need to support informal caregivers of people with dementia. The article begins by stating that caregivers are indispensable to maximizing the well-being of people with dementia. But I did find some numbers in some supplementary reading that really helped me understand just the really staggering scope of the care that is being provided. A report by Alzheimer's Disease International stated that informal caregiving accounts for approximately 40% of the annual cost of dementia care in high-income countries. And in low-income countries, it accounts for 70 to 90% of the cost of dementia care. So that is obviously just the vast majority of care that is being provided through these informal care avenues. The second numbers that stood out to me was in 2015, informal home care provided to people with dementia amounted to 82 billion hours globally, and that is the equivalent amount of work of over 40 million full-time workers. So again, just massive numbers that are hard to wrap your mind around. But I'm sure just when we think in our own personal circumstances, we can think of people in our lives who are providing this type of care and just the amount of work and the effort that goes into it. And basically, we're seeing that informal caregivers are absolutely critical to our care infrastructure for dementia patients. However, the research shows that this quote-unquote free care can also still come at a cost. Which leads us into the next section of the article, which is what does the research tell us about the potential toll of being a caregiver? And how does this impact the health of those with dementia? So while caring for a loved one is a worthy and commendable undertaking, doing so can take its toll on caregivers. Most research on caregiver health over the past decade has shown that informal caregivers have more health problems, visit health professionals more frequently, can suffer from isolation, and can have an increased risk for depression and distress. And an important theme that we'll revisit in this review is that poor caregiver health also has a clear negative impact on the health and lives of those receiving care. In fact, poor caregiver health ultimately leads to an increased likelihood of patients being moved into institutional care facilities. So, what was the specific intent of this systematic review that we're looking at? Research looking at caregiver support has been systematically reviewed in the past. That said, considering the breadth of new evidence that has emerged recently, the authors determined that an update was in order, and they set out to address the following question. And that question was, by giving support to informal caregivers of people with dementia, what impact is seen on, one, the well-being of the caregiver, and or two, the well-being of those who receive care from said caregivers? How do the authors classify these supportive interventions that they were looking at? The authors found 53 articles that met their inclusion criteria for their systematic review. And they divided their results into five main categories based on type of interventions. These categories included psychoeducation interventions, respite care, occupational therapy interventions, cognitive behavioral therapy, and miscellaneous interventions. Each of these five categories was then subdivided into whether the study looked at individual or group interventions. And this was done to help the authors determine whether one mode of delivery was more effective than the other. So for the studies that looked at OT interventions, what specific kinds of interventions were included? The systematic review looked at 8 studies featuring occupational therapy interventions. 7 of these were delivered on an individual basis to the clients, and in one study, it was looking at an intervention delivered in a group. In the OT Potential Club, I'll provide a pretty full summary of what was happening in these 8 different studies. But for the purpose of this podcast, I'll just let you know that overall, the types of interventions included things like education, environmental modifications, functional testing, strategies for the control of reactive behaviors, identification of potential triggers. And for the one group study, it was focused on reminiscing. And also as far as duration, most of these studies had about 10 visits that were an hour to 90 minutes. And I should mention too, if you are not a member of the club, you can of course seek out this article and kind of dig into the interventions in that way too. The second thing I wanted to cover was what assessments were used in the OT studies. Between the 8 studies, there were about 25 different assessments that were used, some of which were focused on the care of the client or the person with dementia. And those featured some assessments you might be familiar with, like the AMPS, the Assessment of Motor and Process Skills. And then a portion of the assessments looked specifically at caregiver health and caregiver self-efficacy and included things like the Zaret burden interview. I did go ahead and list all 25 of the assessments in the club, so you can check them out there. So what OT-specific results did the authors find? All 7 of the occupational therapy interventions delivered to individuals showed benefits, which I thought was awesome. And they specifically found good results, especially in caregiver self-efficacy and decreased behavioral problems among care recipients. So for things like modifying the environment, this boosted the caregiver's belief in themselves and their belief that they could undertake this task of caregiving. And for the client with dementia, things like modifying the environment help decrease behavioral problems. The one group-based occupational therapy intervention that I mentioned where they did the reminiscing, that was the one occupational therapy study where the review did not find any benefits. So those were the results related to the OT interventions. But as I mentioned, there were 4 other categories of interventions that they looked at. So I wanted to touch on those too. And occupational therapy interventions were not the only type of intervention that seemed to work. Psychoeducational interventions generally led to positive outcomes for caregivers, as well as delayed institutionalization of care recipients. In fact, I took note that one study found that recipients of this type of intervention stayed at home 557 days longer than the control group on average. And that is obviously hugely significant for those patients and for those families. Cognitive behavioral therapy also showed some promise. It was shown to decrease dysfunctional thoughts among caregivers. And then the research on respite care was so sparse, they really couldn't draw that many conclusions about it. And the miscellaneous interventions were so diverse, there also weren't great conclusions about that. And the one other interesting thing to note from the results that overall interventions that were delivered on an individual basis had better outcomes than those delivered in groups. So what did the authors conclude and discuss from these results? The authors concluded that supporting caregivers is important and it is effective. Doing so has the potential to improve the well-being of both the caregiver and the care recipient. Now, that being said, there was not a clear front runner in the type of interventions that should be recommended, as there were just many in the study that had positive outcomes. So further studies will be needed to determine which interventions are most cost effective and overall which ones might be recommended in the future. So what were the takeaways for OT practitioners from this research? First of all, these are my personal takeaways, and overall, they were not mentioned specifically in the article. My first of my three takeaways was just that intervention can positively impact both caregiver health and patient health. And I just wanted to hammer home that supporting caregivers seems to be an effective way to support our patients. This makes so much intuitive sense, but it can easily be forgotten or lost on us. I think partially due to our current reimbursement models, which I'll touch on in my third takeaway. And as OTs, caregiver support fits incredibly well within our paradigm of therapy. And research like this should embolden you to be a leader in involving caregivers in your interventions. My second takeaway, again, just echoes the research that there is not one universal intervention approach that works best. So at this point, it seems like individualized care is the way to go. The research on this topic is just in a really interesting place where we know that supporting caregivers seems to work, but there isn't a clear right or wrong way to do it. So this should free you up to focus on the individual needs of each patient and caregiver in front of you. There are a lot of assessments that were mentioned in this article that may be helpful as you determine how to measure outcomes and tailor your treatments to meet each client's and caregiver's needs. And my third and final takeaway is that our reimbursement models really need to be modernized to reflect this more holistic understanding of health. Because honestly, for me, this study just made our reimbursement models feel super outdated. In general, most reimbursement wants us to pay only for, quote unquote, treating the patient. And currently, caregiver training has to kind of be creatively worked into our goals and documentation. In other words, lots of times our reimbursement models are way more concerned with how much assistance is needed versus who is providing it. When in reality, these two things should be equally important because they cannot be separated. And I know just for myself and my past practice that I have absolutely fallen into this narrowly focused trap at times. I've neglected to take the extra time to involve caregivers in my plans of care, let alone taken any time to focus on how I can specifically support their health. But this is the kind of research that reminds me that it is worth the extra effort to involve caregivers, even in our imperfect reimbursement systems. And it's also a reminder that over time, we need to be advocating for reimbursement models to reflect this best practice. I know after reading this article, I just personally had a lot of questions about just what it can look like to be supporting caregivers better. And so I'm really excited to be bringing on our guest, who is Dr. Brandi Archie. Dr. Archie received her doctorate in occupational therapy from Creighton University. She is certified in both living in place and low vision therapy. She has 13 years of experience in home health, neuro, and elder-focused practice settings. Brandy is currently serving as the founding director of Access Able Living, a company whose mission is to adapt environments to fit the needs of older adults and keep them living safely in their homes in Missouri and Kansas. So without further ado, I am going to patch Brandy into our call so we can talk to her about this research. Welcome to the podcast, Brandy. It's great to have you today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
I am just really thankful to be talking about this topic with you today. It is a topic that I'm not sure the article fully captured this for me, but it's an emotional topic. As I think about caregiving, I think of it as kind of one of the most emotional roles that we step into in our adult lives. And both as professionals, we'll experience helping people with this, but also on a personal level, lots of us at some point will be in this caregiving role. So I'm really excited to be digging into it deeper today. And I'm specifically excited to be digging into it with you because of your unique experience. I said a little bit in your intro about your business, but to start us off, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your business, specifically about home modifications and how you encounter caregivers in your work.
Yeah. So I'm the founding director of Accessible Living, and we use adaptive equipment to help make people's lives easier. So the way that we work is by coming to their home and doing an assessment. And this could be for anybody with any need, but the majority of our clients tend to be those who are elderly, or mostly the people who call us are the caregivers. And so that's how we interact with caregivers. I don't know other people's experiences, but in my experience, the people who need the help are not usually the ones who are asking for the help, because they're saying, oh yeah, I can do it. I still can get in and out the tub and I can still do blah, blah. But it's the caregivers who may live there or may just be like a daughter who comes over and does the laundry and checks on them on a regular basis and just notices the challenges that they're having. And so although not all of our patients have dementia, we work with caregivers almost the most, really. And so we're privy to what their needs are and what their and the emotionality of caring for a loved one is. And so we figure out what the problems are. We do a home assessment. We give them a set of prioritized solutions. And like, these are the ways that we think we can make this easier for you. And then we make those things happen. I hadn't found in my practice over the course of the past 14 years that there was a comprehensive solution like that within the healthcare system. And so that's kind of why I stepped out and created Accessible Living, so that we could package all of that together into one service, again, for the caregivers who are struggling with a loved one who just got out of the hospital or a big change in status and trying to manage a whole lot of things at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really struck when I first started practicing what a knowledge gap I had and what it took to actually make some of the modifications I was recommending. Like, I would recommend a ramp, but have no idea how much it costs, logistically how to do that, and what a burden to put that on someone who's already doing a lot in their life to figure something else like that out. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing. I had one question. Are you usually private pay or do you take insurance? What's your reimbursement model?
That is such a good question. So it is a hybrid system in that almost everything that you might need for your home to be modified is not covered by insurance. So from the basics like a shower chair on up to the more expensive things like tearing out the shower, the tub and putting in a shower or building a ramp, none of that is covered. But there are a few things that are covered, and a custom wheelchair is one of them. And so we do those wheelchair evaluations because it's really helpful to do those in the home so we can get the right piece of equipment so we can bill insurance for the wheelchair and the wheelchair evaluation, because that's therapy and we can bill insurance for that. So it's kind of a model. And we try to mix and match. We also do refurbished equipment, which really helps to bring down the cost and make things accessible for just about everybody. And then we work with a lot of programs in the city in order to help people find funding. So it's really a mishmash of as many things as we can try to organize together to make it all work out. And to your point about like recommendations that OTs make, it's super easy to say you need a ramp and a whole lot harder to make it happen. And not only is it a barrier for the family to try to figure it out, but it's also hard for individual therapists to try to be working in the hospital and keep up on who's a good contractor and how long a ramp do we actually need? And you don't even get to go see the house. And so it's actually a barrier for both sides of the equation, which is why we feel like accessible living is a good plug-in in the middle of the two.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like this article and this conversation for me exposed so many gaps in our current healthcare model, which I had seen, but never thought so explicitly about. Mm-hmm. So to turn to the article, I guess my first question, just like very basic level and high level, is why do you think it's important for occupational therapists to be considering the support of caregivers as they're delivering care to their clients?
I think the very first thing is that if you're working with anybody with any degenerative disease process, so dementia or Parkinson's or anything that's going to continue to get worse, caregivers are really required. Even if they're not required 24/7 at the moment that you encounter that person, they're really part of the process, right? And if your goal is to help your patient reach their goals, the really only way to make sure that happens well, especially in the way that our healthcare funding is happening now, is you have to get follow-through from the caregiver. So I'll use home health, for example. There's been a bunch of changes with PDGM, and people are not getting as many visits as they used to get. And so it's even more of a consultative kind of model that we think of more for like school-based. And so you really have to get not only the buy-in from the caregiver, but have them be well-equipped to help carry out the things that you're recommending so that people achieve the goals that you're trying to actually achieve. And so instead of looking at caregivers as ancillary, as like, oh, let me make sure I tell them what I did today in my session, I think it's really important to incorporate them within the session in whatever way is most effective and however you work. It looks different in every setting for sure, but you really need them to be a part of it. And also for you to understand what their goals are too, because the patient's goals are important, but it's also really important to understand what the caregiver's goals are for the patient, for themselves, and see how you can be an agent of change in their situation. And then like the last thing is, especially based on this article, it's really effective based on the research. And so I really enjoyed reading this because it put real data behind something that I was seeing happening in my practice. And then it gives you even more fuel to understand like, okay, I really should, even if I want to give this caregiver a break while I'm here today with their loved one and working with them, let me make sure that next week I include them in the session so that we can make XYZ progress based on what we see in these articles.
Yeah, I was kind of taken aback, and or I guess my expectations were subverted by this article at how just seemingly effective it was to help caregivers. I guess before I read it in my mind, that would have been kind of an indirect way to help our patients. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that their lives and health are so intertwined that now as I'm thinking of it, I'm like, oh, of course we need to be supporting caregivers. Mm-hmm. And that is an opportunity that I look back on my practice and I know that I have missed tons of opportunities to involve the caregiver more in my care with patients. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to just like the current gaps and I guess obstacles of involving caregivers in our care right now.
Yeah, I think that as therapists, working within America's medical system, it's super easy to miss dealing with the caregivers because the healthcare focus is on the patient. Although we're trying to move towards more preventative care and like not just getting paid for the stuff that you do, like procedures that are performed, we're not there yet, right? And so what you are getting paid for as a therapist is to treat the individual patient, right? Mrs. Smith is your patient, not Mrs. Smith's son, right? And so you have to try to focus directly on her and try to make change in her life. However, we all know that, especially with dementia, the caregiver has to be a part of the situation. And so I think that sometimes it can be hard to understand how to document what you're doing in order to continue to get paid through the healthcare system that we work through, but make the change that you're trying to make. I also think there's limited options that are directly for the caregiver that are accessible. So I know that we can refer people to support groups in general, but for something very specific, like how do I solve XYZ problem with my mom, support groups are not necessarily the best way for that. And I think this research article kind of proved that out as well. And besides that, as a therapist, what else do I do if I'm not exactly sure how to include the caregiver in my treatment? And that's why I think it's so important to just work together as a team, everybody as a group, and starting from the evaluation, you know, you're evaluating what the patient can or cannot do, but also you need to understand what their lifestyle is like together as a family or as a group, whether that's their son comes over 3 times a week and does these 8 IADLs for them, or she says she does her medicine by herself, but actually her son calls 3 times a day to make sure it happens, you know, and you won't really know those things unless you involve the caregivers. And the other thing is in every setting, you might not have the caregiver right there. So like at home health, if they live with them, you're going to have the caregiver there. So it's going to be a lot easier to incorporate it. If you're in acute care or inpatient rehab, especially now with COVID, you're not going to have a caregiver there, mm-hmm. right? Because they're not going to be able to be present. And it's going to take extra time from you as a therapist to call the caregiver and connect with them and, you know, get that information that you need to work with them. So I feel like there's a lot of barriers to doing this. But if your goal is to help your patient in the best way that you can, it's super important to try to find a way to make it work. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And to your point about support groups, that's what I would have thought of off the top of my head as the most readily available resource out there. But after reading this research, I was like, what we really need is more OTs doing like the work that you're doing, where they're getting in to the nitty gritty of the patient's lives and making an individualized plan for them. Based on your reading and your experience, what would you say are just some of the key components of OT interventions that would focus more on supporting caregivers and the patient?
I think my experience says something different than what the research says. So the research said that the things that were most effective for OT intervention, all of those programs were either 10, you know, at the minimum, 10 sessions over the course of 5 weeks, up to 15 sessions over 3 months. And I'm trying to think of a practice setting where you get that much time with people. Yeah. And unless it's like a specific program, which these were, because it's a research study, right? So they've got to organize yes. it specifically. But in our everyday practices, you know, you're not getting that at the acute inpatient level. You're not, you maybe used to get it at home health level, but kind of not so much anymore. Not 10 sessions. You might get 5 weeks, but you're not getting 10 sessions. And then for outpatient, you could make that work in outpatient, but then you also run into the barrier of, does your patient have a copay and are they really trying to have the most minimum number of sessions with you because of that copay? So while I see the research saying what has been most effective is long-term working with people, I think that we have a challenge in the way our system is set up to make that happen. But the good thing I think is we know that it is effective and the longer you can work with somebody, the better. So finding some ways to like continue to follow up, if you can stretch your visits out over a long period of time and try to give them as many resources and as much meat as you can in the short number of visits that you have, is really helpful. And then, so that was the first thing that stood out to me, was how much treatment mm-hmm. was provided, right? And then the research also showed what they did in those sessions. So I think the key things is training the caregivers to use coping strategies in order to help the person be as autonomous and independent and participate in social activity as possible. And then they focus on quality of life instead of like specific ADL improvement. Like, is it more important that we do this very complex thing in order to get Mrs. Smith to take a shower independently? Or is it actually better to let her have some supervision, set the situation up so that she can have some supervision, and then that allows her to feel more independent throughout the day because she's dressed and ready to go. And now she's got the energy to make her own breakfast, let's say. And so that's different for every situation, but like really considering what's the quality of life aspect, as opposed to I need my patient to be modified independent with dressing, modified independent with toileting, modified independent with whatever we have on the list of like FIM scores, basically. And then the third thing that they did for intervention was identifying the triggers of the behaviors as opposed to treating the behaviors, right? Like as a therapist, you might want to look directly at the patient and say, okay, they're super anxious and they get worked up very easily. And then that's when everything starts to crumble. So let's work on the patient having more resilience and not getting so anxious. Okay, yes, that's true, but that's kind of putting a band-aid on a gushing wound, right? We need to go back another step. Why are they getting so anxious? What is a trigger for this behavior? And if you can go back to figure that out, then maybe you don't have to deal with the behavior at all. You don't have to train the caregiver to be like, this is how you talk them down. This is how you match and mirror in order to bring their mood back into a more manageable state. How about we just not get to that state? So what is the trigger of that? And so those are the things that prove to be the most effective. And I think that in my experience, that's really what I've tried to drill down to. And when I've done a good job at that, that's when we've made the most progress, right? Like getting to the ultimate goal, the heart of the matter, right? And like going all the way back. And when you do that, you inevitably have to work with the caregiver. So I the way I define that is like having an ultimate goal mindset. So is my ultimate goal independence with toileting, or is my ultimate goal that they have a better quality of life and a more independent day, you know, less behaviors, right? And so if I keep the main thing, and then I go work myself backwards, I think it's a lot easier to incorporate some of these interventions that were proved to be effective and helpful for not only the caregiver, but also for the patient. I like to ask myself the question, how can I affect the most change to achieve a goal? You know, I can't do everything. You know, I'm not there every day. I don't get as many visits as I used to get. But what ways can I make an improvement in this life that's going to last past my time with them? And, you know, that's just a different way of asking that ultimate goal question. And then once you answer that for yourself, it makes it a lot easier to make a plan that's effective.
Yeah.
And have the caregiver buy into it, right? As opposed to them just managing the schedule and figuring out when you're going to go see their mom and like, yeah, how's it going? Blah, blah. You know, if they're on board with your plan, like the goal is for her to be able to do this thing. And, you know, that means that you won't have to call three times a day because we figured out a way for her to take her medicines a little bit more independently. You know, they're going to be on board with that because like that frees me up to be a son again, as opposed to a caregiver, you know? And so I think asking yourself those questions when you're seeing patients can really be helpful, not just dementia, but anybody who is involved with a caregiver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you were saying that, I was thinking about how in some ways our, how we document things and how we're reimbursed can over time like narrow our view of what you're doing. And I hear you pushing us to like expand that. And even if we are documenting about toileting, to be thinking bigger picture for our patients and remembering that that is our ultimate goal, whether or not we break our documentation into more specific goals. I want to push a little deeper into just the logistics of what this works of what this looks like in your practice. I'm trying to wrap my mind around it. I'm hearing that you probably get less sessions and you're having this ultimate goal mindset. I don't know. Can you just elaborate a little bit more on what supporting caregivers looks like in your particular practice?
Yes. So since we're like a hybrid model, I don't know that it's necessarily applicable to everybody's practice, but I think that what we start always with is what are the problems. And if we do a really good job evaluating the problems, the solutions come out a little easier. And so most of the time I'm encountering people for one thing, but we actually foray into a bunch of other things. And as we realize what the whole picture is. So for example, I might get a referral to do a power wheelchair evaluation for a client, let's say with Parkinson's. And when I get to the home, we need to talk about what their mobility status is like, but we also need to consider where they're going with the wheelchair and who's helping them do what. And then we come up with, oh, actually, they need to be able to get on and off the toilet, and this chair is not going to be the solution for that. And actually, I'm never going to take this chair out of the house because the way I go out of the house is with the caregiver, but that's really challenging. So now we're talking about how do we do community reintegration? What are some things that we do to make that easier? And so I like to use one like way in to deal with the bigger picture, mm-hmm. so that then we're, again, making, how can I make the biggest impact as a person in this setting? And so while I may only see that person that one time for that wheelchair evaluation and then follow up to train on that, we've actually dealt with multiple problems at the same time in order to make the biggest impact. So I think that can be extrapolated into other people's practices, because if you are an acute therapist who's seeing somebody just a few times before they go home, you got the capacity to be able to do some of those things too, even though you don't get that 10 sessions over a 5-week period. And the other thing I like to think about is I might be the only OT that somebody ever encounters. And so I can't always expect that somebody down the line is going to solve this problem for them. And so I try to be knowledgeable enough to direct people in the right way for as many things as possible. So it's important to me that we be as educated as we can about how to guide people in the right way, right? Even if it's outside of your scope to do all those things. But just knowing a little bit about everybody else's area of practice or the resources that are available in your city or the things they should be considering as they take the next step to wherever they're going, just so that they're as well informed as possible. And so to me, in my practice, the caregiver cannot be untangled from the patient at all. It always has to come together, because we focus on the home. You know, the other thing is, I might come in and say, okay, Mrs. Smith is having this trouble. She can't get up and down from the toilet. She can't get in and out the bed, and she needs to have a place to sit in the shower. So I can recommend a shower chair, a riser on the toilet, and let's say a rail on the bed, right? And that might be perfect for her. However, her husband might be irritated with the fact that there's this riser on the toilet and he thinks it's harder to clean and he doesn't like sitting on it because he's shorter than her. I got to take that into consideration, right? If they've only got one bathroom in the house, is there a way that we can make both of them happy? You know, in the long run, he might say, sure, make all those changes because my wife needs it. In the short term, I should say. But in the long run, if that makes him more irritable overall and he becomes less of the person that he normally is, he has, let's just say, more of an attitude or has less patience with her because every time he wakes up in the morning, he hates getting on that toilet because I put that riser on it. You know, in the long run, that's bad for their relationship as husband and wife, but also as their relationship of caregiver and patient. And so that seems like a small thing that maybe he should just get over. But if I can ameliorate that at the beginning so we don't go down this long pathway, then, you know, that is my best effort at, you know, making the best change possible. And maybe we come up with a different solution. Maybe we use a bedside commode on top of the toilet so he can move it out of the way when he gets to go to use the bathroom, and he'll put it back when she goes on. That seems like a lot more work to me, but he might like that better, yeah. You know? And so I think thinking outside the box and like and making sure you're incorporating everybody is super important. And so for me, going into people's homes regularly, I think that's the main way I see supportive caregivers playing out in my practice. That was a long, windy answer, but I hope that answered what you were saying.
Yeah. And that's just making me think a lot about, I think we think about as therapists about how complex our patients are and multifaceted, but then to go the next level of to think about how complex, like the dynamics of like a husband and wife, where, and especially where one's a caregiver, like you are headed into very complex territory there. And yeah, you have to be sensitive to preferences. And I even think about me and my husband, and we do things in ways that might seem crazy, but we're like, that's what works for us.
Yep.
And I think that OTs are poised to navigate that complexity, but we also need to be ready and aware of what we're stepping into there.
Yeah. Because you could take it as like, these are my recommendations and this is what's best for you, so do it, right? And be irritated when they don't do it. But if the ultimate goal is to help your patient reach XYZ goal, and the way you've recommended them doing it is not happening because they don't do it, you haven't reached your goal, even though what you gave them was a perfectly good plan, right? And so, you know, I've even had people not want to specifically, I'll stick with the toilet, not want to put different adaptive equipment in their bathroom because they only have one bathroom and their grandkids come over. And when somebody comes over to use the bathroom, they don't want them to see that in there or be worried about them getting up and down from the toilet. And although I can say, how many visitors do you have compared to how many times do you have to go to the bathroom? That, and they might cognitively understand that if their emotions are tied up in not wanting that to happen and not wanting to have, you know, certain things present when other people are around, they're not going to do what I asked them to do. Mm-hmm. And then that goal is not achieved. And then yeah. we still are falling off the toilet and we're calling for help. You know what I'm saying? And, or we can't get up and we're stuck there for 30 minutes until we get enough strength to get up off the toilet. So what did my really great recommendation do to make an improvement in mm-hmm. their life, right? Like it didn't. So let me, even though it seems silly to me, let me figure out a way to make yeah. it work for you that you can be proud of, or you can, you know, adhere to, follow through with, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's how I feel about it.
Yeah. Our autism guest called that being tempted to be like performative as a therapist, like wanting to come up with like the perfect right solution. But sometimes we can get lost in that and lose track of this isn't going to work for that patient, or they're not going to do it. Even if it is in our mind, the perfect solution, yeah. it's not the perfect solution if it doesn't work for them specifically. Totally. I wanted to drill a little deeper just for a little bit into your work, working with caregivers to do home modifications. Like I said, that feels like a gap still in my knowledge. And if you could just tell us a little bit about what that looks like in your practice.
Sure. I'll start with when I was a less experienced therapist, I would get a patient whose main issue was dementia, right? And maybe I'm seeing them in a setting where we're dealing with a hip fracture or something else. But like the main reason they can't achieve their goals is because of their memory and their dementia. And I'd say, how am I really going to make any change when their recall ability is limited and they have limited ability to learn new skills? You know, as OTs, we are experts at getting people to change their habits that they've been doing for 80 years and make them do it a different way so they can be independent. So teaching people new skills is something we do all the time. But if somebody doesn't have the capacity really to learn a new skill, at least in the time frame that you have to work with them, what can I really do to make change? And I think that's really the diving off point where I got kind of more interested into managing people's environments in order to support their abilities best and encourage more effective choices or actions. And this is something that we as OTs are really skilled at being able to do if we really stop to think about it. But it's also something that's happening in the world at large, you know, like having the milk and bread in the back of the grocery store is intentional so that you go through the store and you buy some chips on the way to the back, right? Like they're setting up exactly. They're setting up the environment to benefit them at most, right? So that you spend the most money. And we can take that kind of psychology and like ways of changing environments in order to do good things too, mm-hmm. instead of just spending more money. So when I come at it from that aspect, there's a lot of ways to modify a home in order to facilitate the best ability of a person with dementia. So for some examples, the first place I start at is what they're having trouble doing and what are some of the caregivers' problems. And for example, one thing I hear a lot is, I don't sleep very well because I'm always worried about them getting up and wandering out of the house, or wandering out of their room and tripping and falling on something. Let's say it's a daughter who's living with a mother. So they're not sleeping in the same room or in the same bed, but she's kind of trying to stay awake, hears any little sound. You know, I could look at that as, well, we should probably get her a sleeping pill so that the patient stays asleep longer and heavier, and you could deal with it that way. But you could also put a floor mat alarm down. So that we might be used to bed alarms from hospitals and skilled mm-hmm. nursing facilities, they make it the opposite way. So when you put some pressure on it, that's when the sound goes off. So you could place that mat right where her feet end up when she gets out of the bed. So now instead of being alerted every time she's rustling around, you know that if you hear this alarm, she's out of the bed. Or maybe mm-hmm. that's too close. You could put that at the doorway. Now you know she's at the door. Whatever works for you, right? Like that's a simple addition to allow you to sleep better, because now you know you can just listen for that alarm, right? Mm-hmm. Also, like motion activated or light sensitive night lights are helpful because maybe we can't stop the wandering behavior. You want her to be able to independently get up and walk to the bathroom, but you want her to be safe when she does it, right? So while she may not remember to turn on a light, if you have automatic lights on, so as soon as she walks past it, it comes on, or as soon as it's dark in the room, the lights turn on, then we've automatically created a safer situation. And you can even put a light in the toilet bowl. So you're kind of drawn to go right there as opposed to get distracted and doing something else on the way to the bathroom. Another slick trick is if you're worried about people leaving or wandering out of a place, or you don't want them to go through a certain doorway, you could add a bunch of locks to the door, but you also could put a black floor mat down, because the way our brain works with dementia, it can be perceived as a hole in the floor. And so they're going to just automatically avoid it because they don't want to fall down a hole, right? And so now they're, instead of fumbling with the door all the time, trying to unlock the door, trying to get out, talking about, I need to go get the paper, you know, how we get perseverative with dementia, they're just literally going to avoid it altogether. And now we don't have to deal with that behavior of trying to get out because they've made the decision themselves not to go there, right? And then when we're still dealing with the same setup, the same caregiver worried about sleeping and somebody wandering, a two-way baby monitor can really be helpful. Like, this is not an adaptive device. It's just like what you can find on Target shelves. Mm. But if it connects to your phone and you can talk through it so that wherever the monitor is at, you can talk to the person. You could say, oh, hey, mom, I see you're up. Do you need to go to the bathroom? Yeah, I can't find my house shoes, or whatever she's doing in the moment. You know, you can guide through that without having to come in there, or maybe that gives you the opportunity to run to the store safely because they're taking a nap. And if they happen to wake up, you'll be alerted because the baby monitor will go off. And so those are just some specific ways for dementia that you can add things to your environment in order to, you know, avoid some of the problems that we have, and also support the caregiver who is trying to deal with all of those behaviors, you know?
Yeah, and I can really see how interconnected everything becomes if you're up worrying in the nighttime. Mm-hmm. That is going to tank your mood during the day. So if we can do those things to take that stress out in the evenings, I definitely see how that is effective in supporting everyone's health in that situation. So I want to just ask really specifically about both reimbursement and documentation. I think your last answer like really helped me see how supporting caregivers really fits into our OT framework and just kind of our standard practice. But I think that we as therapists can fall into the trap of thinking of supporting the caregivers as extra work that we don't get reimbursed for, or that it's tough to document for. And I guess I was wondering if you could just speak to those two things kind of lumped together because they're so intertwined, reimbursement and documentation.
Yeah, I think the first thing to think of is if you're dealing with like a physical injury, like a hip fracture, and you're writing the patient will be able to transfer from the wheelchair to the toilet with moderate assistance, MOD A. Who's providing that assistance, right? Like it's a caregiver. It's either you in treatment session, but you know, in between that, it's whoever else is helping them. And so dealing with like dementia or any other kind of issue where caregivers involved is not any different. So we just have to like think about how we write slightly differently. So since I went so in depth about the daughter taking care, living with the mother who has dementia, you can write goals that include the caregiver and the patient together. As long as the patient is in there, you can add the caregiver in there, even though you know the physical output that you're doing is mostly with the caregiver, your goal still includes the patient. So an example could be patient will transfer from bed to the bathroom with modified independent at night, right? So, and in order to make that happen, you had to do all those things we talked about, add the night lights and put the light in the toilet bowl. And so even though you didn't write patient will buy these things and set these things up, you're covering what you're working on, right? Because mm-hmm. this is the way that I'm going to get them to be modified independent with toileting, right? At nighttime specifically, not just any time during the day. And other times I've written goals that say patient with caregiver will exit the home safely without additional cues from therapists, right? So that is wide open, right? I can make sure that together they can get out. Maybe she has to manage the walker, and maybe they have this specific way they got to tell her how to go down the stairs, go down with the bad foot or whatever she has to say to her. It's including the caregiver in the situation, and it's still measurable, right? Because it says no cues from the therapist, because before I've been giving them cues on how to do it, right? And so I think as long as you got a goal that's measurable and that includes the patient in some form, then you can basically write anything. And then the rest of your documentation just justifies that. You talk mm-hmm. about how you educate the caregiver on how to do this thing. And that in turn makes it better for the patient. And just draw the connections in your documentation. Like you were mentioning before about the sleep deprivation from the caregiver. If she sleeps better, then she's more patient during the daytime taking care of her mother. And so write that in your note. Like, we worked on this because there has been increased maladaptive behaviors during the day with interactions between the caregiver and the patient, secondary to sleep deprivation. You could just write that sentence and then say, this is what we're doing to work on that. And when somebody reads that and says, they're not going to say this is not billable, because they can see how that interacts with the patient having the best outcome and the reason that you're there.
And I'm developing this like cavalier attitude towards documentation where I'm like, I dare someone to reject that note where I'm spending time supporting caregivers. Like, I'll send them mm-hmm. this research article. Like, where's their evidence that supporting caregivers doesn't work? Like, no, the evidence is backing that our time spent supporting caregivers does work. It's not an ancillary thing. It's really core to our patient's health. So I'm hearing you say there's definitely ways in our traditional practices for us to be supporting caregivers more. I think my final question around all of this is, what do you see as like an ideal future for us in OT as far as supporting caregivers? In 5 to 10 years, what would you like to see differently about what we're doing and how we're able to do it?
I think the most immediate thing that we can do is to make it a habit of, instead of leaving a caregiver in the waiting room or somewhere else away from your session, that you bring them into it to be a part of it, right?
You've done that, Brandy.
And there is benefit to letting a caregiver have a break. Like, I'm with you on that. Sometimes that hour that they're with you, the patient is with you, is the only time that they have ability to run to the store, do whatever they need to do, right? But bringing them as a part is helpful, I think. Mm-hmm. And then if we have a continued research to show how individual OT is so effective for the patient and the caregiver, it will be nice to be reimbursed in that way, so you don't have to kind of jump through hoops in your documentation mm-hmm. like we just talked about, and that you could just directly, you know, deal with the caregiver directly and you know, say that. I also think, though, that there are a variety of certifications for dementia and Alzheimer's educators. And in my experience, most of those educators end up being social workers or nurses. But what if more were OTs and you actually created a private practice around that, for example? I think that OTs are uniquely excellent at educating, especially when you're combining a diagnosis with learning how to apply that to life. And so becoming a certified dementia or Alzheimer's educator could be a really cool way to, if you're interested in the area, to move forward in either your own practice or to build a program within the place that you work, especially if you deal with a lot of people with dementia, and like can create an effective, for lack of a better term, support group. The research showed that very individual, you know, even couple of people together can really make a difference. And if you created a program around that, by getting that kind of certification, you could really help a lot of people, but also either benefit as an entrepreneur or grow your program at wherever facility that you work at. So I think there's a lot of ways to, I always like to see OT be on a bigger stage. So yeah, in the next 5 to 10 years, OTs being really forefront in the caregiver and the dementia space.
Yeah, there is just a huge need out there. And I really hope if there are people listening who have an interest in this area, that this is something that they pursue because, yeah, there's a need in our traditional settings. There's a need for entrepreneurs. I think every city and town needs a Brandy Archie, someone who, as an OT, is connecting all these different resources and really helping people at that next level beyond just like leaving it at a recommendation, but to bring those recommendations to fruition. I really want to keep talking to you about this, but we are at our rapid fire time already. I had a couple questions to close. I just wanted to ask about you and your practice. My first question is, what is the first sentence that you usually say to patients?
I say, hi, I'm Brandy, and I'm an occupational therapist. So it's my job to help people be as safe and as independent as possible.
Beautiful. What is the last sentence that you usually say to a patient at the end of a session?
I like to say, is there anything that we didn't talk about that's important to you? Mm.
What's your favorite assessment to use?
The home assessment that I developed for our room-by-room evaluation. So it's not certified or any of those things, but that's, I like it because I made it. So of course I like it.
I really want to see that sometime. What is your favorite OT intervention to deliver?
Terrible at favorites. So I have three. Low vision training with equipment. So I love to help people functionally use their vision better. Doing neuromuscular reeducation for stroke patients with a device. You see the trend. I like devices. So like eSTEM or Bioness or Acebo. And then like determining environmental modifications to help improve function at home, which is more devices. I'm a gadget girl.
And what is something that you've read recently that has inspired your OT practice?
It's really nerdy, but the bill proposal to include OT as a provider that can use telehealth permanently. I do a fair amount of telehealth, especially since COVID, and it'd be great if we get to continue to do that even after we've got COVID under control.
Yeah, awesome. And how do you hope a patient feels as they are walking out the door after an initial visit with you?
I like them to feel like they have hope, that something that they thought was unchangeable can actually be affected by change.
Beautiful. Well, Brandy, I want to thank you for your time today. If people do have follow-up questions, we do have a forum in the OT Potential Club where you could ask questions on this podcast episode. Brandy, would you be willing to hop into those comments if anyone had a question in there? Okay.
Yeah.
And Brandy is also going to provide us with a documentation example so you can just really concretely see what she was talking about as far as working within kind of our traditional framework to incorporate the caregiver more. But Brandy, I, again, just wanted to thank you for your time today. Thank you for the really excellent work that you are doing in your practice. And I would love to talk to you again about some of this stuff.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye. Wow, you guys, this week's podcast was just really one of those that pushed me to reconsider my past occupational therapy sessions and gave me some really practical ideas for how I could do better by my patients in the future. And I hope that it was the same for you. If you are interested in earning a certificate for your time today, so this qualifies as official continuing education, what you are going to do next is head to otpotential.com and either sign in or sign up for the OT Potential Club. Like I mentioned before, the OT Potential Club is our OT evidence-based practice platform. It is currently only $49 to have access to our courses and to the many resources in the club. So if you are not yet a member, I just highly encourage you to sign up. Once you are in there, you can click on the button that says CE Courses. And when you find this particular course, you will be prompted to take a 5-question test. And if you earn 75% or higher, you will have a certificate sent to your inbox. Okay, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I hope this podcast helps you broaden your knowledge, tweak your practice, and stay evidence-based. Take care, and we'll talk to you next month.